In part by Euromart International Food Store on Springfield and Locust in Champaign, offering 200 kinds of cheeses, 25 kinds of olives, and 100 kinds of olive oil. The Euromart hosts a cheese and olive tasting every Saturday. Today's broadcast is made possible in part by a grant from The Great Impasta, a restaurant serving foods from northern Italy. The Great Impasta is at 114 West Church in Champaign. The staff at The Great Impasta encourage you to join them in supporting WILL AM 580.
Don't miss your chance to win one of 10 major prizes for your home in the WILL sweepstakes. Time's running out. Your entry must be postmarked by September 6 to win the high-definition TV, the sewing machine, or lounge chair and ottoman. If you need an entry form, call WILL at 217-333-0850.
Good morning. Welcome back to the second hour of Focus 580. It's our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Producing the program, Harriet Williamson, Travis Stansel, and Henry Frayne at the controls. Tomorrow morning in the first part of the program, we'll be talking with Omer Bartov. He's professor of European history at Brown University and has done some writing and research on how Jews have been represented in cinema in the 20th century. We'll be talking about that. He'll be here to give a talk in the Millercom series, first one this fall, and he'll visit with us tomorrow morning. In the second part of the show, the guest is lawyer, novelist Tim Junkin, who has written a new book about the first death row inmate to be exonerated by DNA. And so that'll be in the second part of the show. We're here weekday mornings from 10 until noon. We have 10 different topics every week, and we always welcome your questions and comments. In this part of Focus 580, we will explore some of the history behind the development of penicillin. And chances are, if people know anything at all about this story, they will know the name of Alexander Fleming, the man who is credited with having discovered penicillin. This was in 1928. However, it was quite a number of years before penicillin became readily available and an option for doctors who were treating people who had very serious medical problems. And it was not due to the work of Alexander Fleming, but in fact due to a team of scientists at Oxford University who were directed by a man named Howard Florey. However, he didn't get the credit, many people would say he did not get the credit that he deserved, even though he and one of his colleagues did receive, along with Alexander Fleming, the Nobel Prize in 1945 for developing penicillin. This whole story is told in a recent book that we'll be discussing here this morning. The title of the book is The Mold in Dr. Florey's Coat, The Story of the Penicillin Miracle, and we'll at some point, I'm sure, tell you the story behind the title. Our guest for the program is Eric Lax. He has written a number of books, including biographies of Woody Allen. His work has appeared in many magazines and newspapers, including the New York Times Magazine, Vanity Fair, The Atlantic, Life, Esquire. And he is the author of this newly published book, Mold in Dr. Florey's Coat, which is published by Henry Holt, out there now in bookstores if you'd like to read it. And, of course, questions are welcome here in Champaign-Urbana if you'd like to call 333-9455. And we have that toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So at any point here, if you have questions, you are certainly welcome to call. Mr. Lax, hello.
Good morning.
Well, thanks for talking with us today.
My pleasure. Call me Eric, will you?
Oh, all right. I guess we certainly should start with by talking about Alexander Fleming.
Okay.
And the fact that he did indeed, he was a man who studied bacteria. And there is this story that has been told about the fact that he was working in his laboratory and he had some staff in a petri dish.
Right.
And that by accident, some spores of this penicillin got in there. And he also noticed, perhaps also by accident, that in the areas where the mold was growing, there was no staff.
Right. It was almost an aftersight that he which he had.
Mm-hmm. And so that's kind of the story, the version of the story that has come down to us. And one of the things that you look at in the book is, well, this question is that really how this happened?
Right. How it might have had that. It's generally true. And then from there, it goes into other directions.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, generally, that's true. How much do you think what really happened is off of the story that everybody has heard?
What's true is that in 1928 he went on vacation in the summer, and that he as he once said was notoriously kind of messy and what have you. He said he could never have had a job in a real research laboratory, And that's actually one of the great benefits to medicine that he didn't, because without his original discovery, I think things would have slowed down considerably. At any rate, he goes off, and when you're working on things in a lab, you're covering the dishes, but you take the tops off, you take the tops, put them back on, and anything in the air can get in. The great thing that happened, he goes away, comes back a few weeks later, he's sitting by his workbench cleaning everything off, and a friend comes in just to see how things are going, and he says, "Oh my gosh!" He says, "You know, look at all this mess that I have here. He just would put them into a really kind of like a little dishpan that had the equivalent of Lysol in it to kill everything on there, so he could reuse the dishes. And stacked up above the line was this dish of Staphylococcus. He said, "Look at that! Here's this thing." And he just reached over and he pulled it over and he lifted off the lid, and then he looked at it for a second, and then he was a very laconic guy, and he said, supposedly, that's funny. And what was funny was that here was this mold, but around it, rather like the walls of Jericho, everything had just collapsed. And he said, "Well, wait a minute. How did that happen? What was in this mold that killed all of the cells that were around it?" He spent the next several years trying to discern exactly what that was, and was unable to do it. Biochemistry really had not come along. He was not a biochemist. What he did was he found that you could almost extract whatever it was in the mold. But then, remember the movie The Scarlet Pimpernel? You know, you seek him here, you seek him there. Yes. That was penicillin. It would just vanish at the last moment, and it was so elusive that finally he gave up on it, really, in 1932. Mm. And penicillin was really kind of a curiosity that was forgotten for the next several years. A little work was done here and there, but in 1935, the sulfa drugs came along, and everyone thought that was going to be the great salvation, and then they turned out to have so many side effects that were actually very limiting for him.
So Fleming discovered that penicillin would do this. He coined the term penicillin.
Right.
He wrote a paper about this, but he never really was certain what it was that was doing this, or how it was doing it, or really wasn't able to isolate what was the effective component.
That's
so
correct.
After a while of working this and kind of being frustrated, he just said, "Well, I'll go on to something else." And indeed, he did.
He did. He turned his attention to the sulfa drugs also. Penicillin was, as I said, more or less forgotten until 1938, when a group at Oxford, led by Howard Florey, as you pointed out, a German-Jewish refugee biochemist, Ernst Chain, who had come to Oxford, and Norman Heatley, who I think is the great unsung hero of the story of penicillin, an English biochemist, who was a great practical genius who could... He could make almost anything you needed in the lab. He could, for almost no money, which the shoestring budgets of science at that time cannot be overemphasized. Florey and Chain had been interested in naturally occurring antibiotics. And the other great discovery of Alexander Fleming is a substance called lysozyme, which he had found in 1922, pretty much under the same accidental circumstances. And it turned out to be... you find it in tears and in nasal passages, really in kind of openings to the portals to the body and the mouth. And it's mildly effective. It doesn't really attack anything that makes us ill, but it is an antibiotic. It does kill bacteria, and they were curious about this. And Fleming had been unable to really get to the total nature of lysozyme, and Ernst Chain, under Florey's direction, was able to solve that riddle in 1938 and 1937. And they said, "Well, let's see if we can find anything else in nature that does this." And, you know, this was before computer searches and LexisNexis, so Chain gets there, and he basically pulls down every journal and starts looking through the titles to see what he can find. Among the three papers that he finds, one is Fleming's. And he says, "Oh, that's interesting. You know, let's see. I wonder if that..." And then he remembered not long before that he had seen a mold sample that had been put in. He said, I wonder if our mold keeper has any penicillin. And he goes down the hall, and sure enough, she has some that had come over from Fleming in 1928. So he and Florey decided, "Well, you know, we have this here. Let's start with this one." And it was very serendipitous, of course. They made very great progress very quickly. Hmm. In part because it was a different way of doing scientific research between 1928, when Fleming was working alone, and 1938, when this team was there. Florey, who headed the lab, he was a pathologist, understood that for science to advance, you really had to have an interdisciplinary approach where you could have a number of people working on the problems from an adverse sides. And Chain was particularly instrumental in this because what he was really good at doing was he was sort of a biological reductionist. He would take whatever problem there is, reduce it to its chemical components, and work up from there so that it became a step-by-step building process rather than saying we have this huge problem we have to solve. You break it down into its components and go on from there. And then Heatley was the one who, once they were sitting there looking at this penicillin, and it was doing exactly the same thing as it did with Fleming, which is they'd nearly be able to reach in and grab it, and it would disappear. And Heatley was the one who said he had what he called a laughably simple idea. In its own way it is, but it's one that no one had ever come up with, was that he said, gee, you know, they, without trying to be too complicated here, they were trying to extract it, and they would take it into ether and try to pull it out from there, and then it would disappear. And they said, well, wait, if we've taken it into ether, why don't we just bring it back into water-made alkaline, and it might reappear through there. So it's like a sort of a notional chemical yo-yo that they were doing. And sure enough, that worked. And now they had to come up with a machine to do it. And Heatley kind of cast about. He was very good at pulling glass tubes and making beakers and doing, there were such shortages during the war. He put together an extraction apparatus that was kind of housed in a old bookshelf that had been thrown out by the Bodleian Library. Took him several months to complete it to this final version. It might have cost altogether £5. And it worked. It had electric doorbells on it. It had lights that came off to let you know when bottles were nearly full. Just this great Rube Goldberg device. He was asked by the Science Museum in London 20, 30 years later to build another one because the original one had been dismantled and thrown away. And he did. But he told me that it cost considerably more, and I asked him why. He said the rubbish dumps just aren't what they were in the 1940s.
Well, that points to one of what was the one of the early problems was initially figuring out how it is that you can get the penicillin in the first place, and then figuring out a way to make enough of it so that you could have enough to do the research. And then again, when they started to give it to human subjects, it was difficult. There was one of the stories that you tell in the book about the fact that the first British person that they tried it on was really a sad tale because it was a man who had a raging infection. They gave him the penicillin, it cleared it up, but then it came back, and sadly enough, they didn't have enough penicillin to give him another course of treatment, and the man died.
Yeah, it's really one of those horrible stories where you realize what the possibilities of something are, and then the frustrations of the limitations. Here, it was a Constable Albert Alexander, a member of the Oxford Police Force, a man in his 40s, who on his day off, on an October day, was out in his rose garden, and he scratched his cheek. It really gives you a sense of how little we had to fight infection before antibiotics came along. That little scratch on his cheek turned into this raging bacterial infection that they had to take out an eye. It was so infected he had suppurating wounds. It was really the worst. Just imagine an apple just being eaten from the inside by worms, and that's what was happening to him. He was really on the verge of death when they had finally had enough to give a try on a human. They were comfortable that this was a useful thing, you know, a useful possibility. They tried it on animals, and very quickly great progress was made against the infections. His temperature went down, the pus started to stop, there was clear healing. What they had found early on, and this is just over a course of a few days, what they had found early on in experiments was that a large amount of penicillin it passes through the system unused and is excreted in urine. And so they were collecting his urine, taking it to the lab, freeze-drying it, taking it out, bringing it back, and doing it. Well, they had enough for about 4 days. And at the end of the 4 days, he was in pretty good shape. And it looked as though he was going to have this remarkable recovery. But the great lesson that came out of this was that you have to, when your doctor says, take your antibiotics for 10 days, you really have to take the full course because you need to kill everything that's there. And in his case, not everything had been taken. It had been laid dormant, and much of it had been killed, but the whole infection had not been conquered. And inexorably, it came back, and they didn't have anything to give him. And he died this horrible death that they thought that they had averted. It just is, as Florey called it, a forlorn case. And he said the one thing we learned is that you have to treat it all the way through until everything is gone. But it also laid bare the great problem. Here was a drug of tremendous promise, but making it was very difficult to make it in any large quantity. It was very difficult to do, very hard to extract, and they needed to. And they were growing it. One of the things that I loved about doing this book was just the sense of how they were. Here was Heatley's manufactured machine for £5. It's the wartime. All chemical apparatus, all scientific apparatus is hard to come by. They're using biscuit tins from Huntley and Palmer. They're using pie plates. They have a dog bath they're trying to grow it in. They know they need just a very shallow amount is enough. And the best thing they came up with was an old bedpan from the Radcliffe Infirmary. It grew really, really well in there. A little spout, you could take things in and out. And so finally they had very cheaply made some ceramic pots, about 600 of them, that really looked like a combination between a hot water bottle and a bedpan. And that's how they grew the penicillin at Oxford. But it was also clear that they needed help from the chemical company, who was really, really adept at brewing and at making things. And the English pharmaceutical companies were so either overextended by the war, were so damaged in the case of some in London by the bombing, or so unsure of what the return to them might be, is that there was a fear that this would be synthesized very quickly and that any money they put into making it would be lost, that nobody was really able to help out. And Florey, who had very good relationships with the Rockefeller Foundation going back to the 1920s when he was on a fellowship in America with them, appealed to them, and they really understood what was going on here and said, you know, you get permission to come, we'll get you to America, and we'll put you in touch with all of the pharmaceutical companies and see if we can't get anything to happen. They came to America and, in fact, went to Peoria, to the Northern Regional Research Laboratory, which was very adept at brewing things. They were and they had something called corn steep liquor, which was the byproduct of once you'd made cornstarch. And which was a very good sort of medium for growing things in. And they tried growing penicillin in this after a while and found that it really did increase the yield. And from there, from the work that happened at Peoria, it was able to spread to the pharmaceutical companies. And penicillin really became a practical drug within about a year and a half.
Yeah. And this is a U.S. Department of Agriculture lab that you're talking about, the one in Peoria.
Yes, that's correct. Yeah. What was sort of interesting in retrospect to look at is that the British, in part because they were, you know, when this was first came along there, the Blitz was going on, the Battle of Britain was in full swing. There was terrible devastation, and the country was really just hanging on. Is that it was hard to look ahead to see what it was. The Americans, this was before they were in the war, before we were in the war, grasped that this was really important, and by the end of 1942, the development of penicillin ranked second on the Department of War's list of things they most wanted. The first was the atomic bomb. The second was enough penicillin. I mean, they really grasped what this meant. And the result of that, the war, unfortunately for all the horror that it did, the immediacy of the war really changed changed medicine because there was such a push toward antibiotics.
Yeah. Our guest in this part of Focus 580, Eric Lax. His book is The Mold in Dr. Florey's Coat, The Story of the Penicillin Miracle, published by Henry Holt. It's out now. And questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. I want you to tell the story of the title because here, the research that they were doing in Britain, those were the early years of the war. And the British government felt that there might be this real possibility that Britain could be invaded, and the scientists knew that they would have to destroy their work if that happened, or if it looked like it might happen, because obviously they didn't want it to fall into the enemy hands. So they came up with an unusual way of trying to preserve the material they were working with.
Yes, I was actually grateful for this. One of the problems for any writer, if I can just go off to the side for a second, one of the problems for any writer is, what do you call your book? I knew a book called The Development of Penicillin was not something that
not
would leap
exciting.
Off the table at anyone. And I found that on May the 25th, a Saturday, 1940, they did the first experiment on mice to see how penicillin was worked. Excuse me, I'm going to cough for a moment. And they only had enough to treat four mice. And so eight mice were given a very carefully calibrated dose of staphylococcus, enough to kill a mouse of average weight of streptococcus. And the other four of them received nothing. Two of them received one shot, and the other two received enough to several shots over the next 12 to 16 hours. And it was clear by 3:30 in the morning of the 26th that the mice that received the penicillin were going to be fine. The mice that received no penicillin died within 8 to 12 hours. And at 3:30 in the morning, 3:45 in the morning, Norman Heatley, who had stayed up all night to watch what was going on, is riding home on his bicycle in Oxford. At just the early morning light is starting, and a home guardsman, an aged home guardsman with an aged rifle, jumps out at him, says, "Halt, who goes there?" And he says, "I'm just coming back from the Dunn School." And he doesn't mention that he's just seen the world change. That same night, the evacuation from Dunkirk began, where 350,000 troops were trapped by the Nazis and looked as though they would be captured or killed. And then this great flotilla of private boats and liners and everything came across the channel and rescued so many of them over a period of about 8 days. Well, it was a great bright spot at a very dark time for England, and it was really only a bright spot because there was still the threat of a Nazi invasion, which looked like it could happen at any time. So Florey and the others are saying, well, we have this remarkable advance in medicine in hand, but we have to destroy everything. If they can, how are we going to continue working with this particular strain of mold, this Penicillium notatum that we have, and continue the work? And it's Heatley who came up with the idea. He said, you know, if we take some mold spores and rub them in the lining of our clothes, nobody's going to see them. They'll lie dormant for years if necessary. We get to a safe place, and they can be extracted, and we can get back to work. So, in fact, that's what they did. You know, they all went through the war with incipient fungus in their clothing.
That's a great story. You were talking a little bit earlier about the fact that also because of the pressure of the war on British industry, that made it very difficult to even to think about trying to produce penicillin. And so they came to the United States. They had some work done at this USDA lab in Peoria. Then eventually American drug companies got involved, and there was, when the United States got into the war, there was great priority put on developing penicillin.
Right.
When Florey apparently decided to come to the United States, this was in 1941, and Heatley went with him, but Chain did not. And I'm interested in having you talk about the dynamics between these three men. One of the things you certainly do write about in the book is that Heatley and Chain didn't like each other at all, and it was Chain was the guy who was responsible for bringing Heatley to Oxford.
Yeah.
And so what was these three most important individuals? There were other people certainly that were involved in this work, but the three key guys were Florey, Chain, and Heatley. What sort of relationship did the three of them have with one another?
Right. That was one of the real pleasures of writing, is that when you find that how people get along and how they manage to work with each other. Cambridge and Heatley had both been Chain and Heatley had both been at Cambridge together, and Chain had been recommended to Florey, and then Florey and Chain decided in some of the work they wanted to do, they needed someone who was very good in something called micro methods, which was working on, you know, on a very small scale and kind of measuring the infinitesimal. And Heatley had a very good reputation for that, and so he was invited to come. And Chain had admired his work there. It's hard to imagine three more different people than Florey, Chain, and Heatley. Florey was laconic, witty in his writing, but seemingly very stern. Could not bring himself to praise you to your face. He would say wonderful things about you behind your back if you thought you were going well. But one of the famous example is that one of the young researchers in his lab won a prize for his work. And Florey came up to him afterward and said, you know, congratulations, well done, and then added, of course, it was a very poor field this year. Man had no social skills. Chain was remarkably excitable and voluble. He looked like Albert Einstein, and he was a musician. He had a great artistic temperament, and he debated early in his career whether to be a professional pianist or a scientist. Fortunately, he took science. And he was very histrionic in the lab. As quiet as Florey was and as unemotional, Taine would, you know, rejoice at success and lament failure with regularity. Heatley was the most untraveled of the lot. Had really spent his life within 200 miles of in England, within a 200-mile radius, and was not experienced. Taine was unlike anybody he'd ever run into. He was the antithesis of the English scientist. And so their personalities just didn't mix. And what I was grateful for in the writing of this book is that Heatley, who just died in January of this year, allowed me to use all of his diaries. He had taken out only the part that dealt with penicillin before, and those were available in libraries. But what's wonderful is he gives a great sense of every day in the lab and the relationships between the people. And so you see his frustration with Taine and Taine's with him, and the Heatley's admiration for Florey, whom he held in great regard. And so these three people who, and Taine and Heatley would sometimes, although they were very, very friendly for a long time, would also have arguments that, as Taine once said, you know, the walls of the room would shake from the force of their arguments. In a sort of sad side note, by the time they came to going to America in 1941, although Taine felt that he was and was really Florey's collaborator on this project, which the two of them really had set up together, it was Heatley who had done all of the growing work, who had the three notebooks filled with how the mold grew, how it didn't, how to feed it, how not to feed it. I mean, all these meticulous notes about it was really like trying to figure out, how do you feed a finicky child? What's the best way to get food into this kid? And that was what was the best way to grow penicillin. So when it came time to go to America, it was Heatley who had been in charge of the growing, who was the natural person to take. But because of wartime secrecy, they weren't allowed to tell anyone. Florey told his wife, that was it, that they were going into, but no one in the lab knew. So on the day that they were departing, suddenly Taine comes in to find that Florey and Heatley are going to America, and in half an hour. Well, he's crushed. He said, how can this be? I'm the one doing that. And it really, a downward spiral in the relationship began there, and culminated really in the mid-1940s when they really communicated only by letter. So it's a very sad story on that, but I think it was the right choice for Florey, who knew some of the most prominent people in science in America, and Heatley, who was just the great practical genius, to be the two who did this.
Yeah. Within British science, at least at this time, there apparently was a great reluctance to patent discoveries. They apparently thought that if you discovered something like penicillin, it shouldn't belong to anybody. It should, in effect, belong to everyone.
Right.
Taine, coming out of Germany, had a very different – he had no problem, and apparently German scientists, generally speaking, had no problem with the idea of patenting something. Did that question cause – tension between them?
It caused a lot of tension, and in fact, if there had not been a big argument about patenting in a couple of months before going to America, Taine may not have taken the news quite as badly as he did. There had been a huge argument. Taine was saying, look, he came from an environment where academia and business worked hand in hand, and that patents were just a natural outcome of what happened. Britain was really the land of the amateur, and you things like penicillin were for the general good. There's the great toast that was given at the Cavendish Lab in Cambridge, and where the electron was discovered in 1897, where they used to say, to the electron, may it never be of any use to anyone, which is probably why the Americans developed the transistor radio. This whole notion of you did things largely for the public good was about to come to an end, but it was still very strongly felt in the war. So Taine made the great argument to Florey, saying, let's patent this. Not for us. The money doesn't come to us. It can come to the Dunn School, where they were at Oxford. It could go to the Royal Society, the great scientific organization in London, or it could go to Oxford University. It didn't matter, but you needed to protect the work that they had done. And Florey took it to the higher-ups in England, all of whom said, absolutely not. This is terrible. We won't have anything to do with this. Don't even give it another thought. And so that argument was still raw in Taine's mind. Of course, he was prophetic in a sense in this, in that there was a period in there where after the war, where the British suddenly found themselves paying royalties on a drug that they really felt that they had developed, as Chain had predicted. It's sort of true. What you can patent is a process, and the process that they use for growing it was not as effective as they were growing it. You try to imagine you're just growing something on the surface of something. It's really in two dimensions, and they realized that in America, that for penicillin to be really useful, you had to grow it in three dimensions. You could grow it in a great big vat, you could have an exponentially higher yield. And solving that problem, which Pfizer did, really was the great change. And so the Pfizer process would have taken away the British patent. But the notion of saying, you know, we came up with this first, we should at least patent what we've done. Now, of course, it's done all the time. I mean, you look at the difference in just really in 60 years that there was a period where you just that science and commerce in England simply were, for the most part, quite separate. Where now in America, if you go to a hearing at the FDA on a new drug, half the audience are people from financial institutions who were there taking a look to see, well, do we buy this stock or do we sell it, and are rushing out afterward on the recommendation of what happens to do this. And hardly a scientist anywhere who comes up with something interesting doesn't immediately file for an IPO. If you look at SARS, within 80 days of the outbreak of SARS, teams in three countries, some in Hong Kong and Canada and at the and in Atlanta, the Centers for Disease Control, had all come up with various understandings about it. Each of them had filed for patents within 80 days on SARS that would have controlled anything that came out of it. That change in 60 years is really amazing.
A little earlier, you told the story about the first test on a human, this British policeman, Albert Alexander, how he was working in his garden. He just happened to get a scratch, turned into a terrible infection. They used penicillin on him, and he dramatically improved. And then, sadly enough, he had a relapse, and they couldn't do anything about it because they didn't have enough penicillin to give him more. So that was the first test on a human. Maybe you might tell the story of the first, I believe this was the first American to be treated with penicillin. And there,
yes,
the outcome was a lot more successful.
It was a lot more successful. Florey and Heatley had come to America, and in fact, Florey had returned. This was early 1942, March of 1942. And Heatley had been asked to stay on at Merck, the pharmaceutical company in New Jersey, to try to help them with penicillin. And Florey encouraged him to stay because Florey's whole point in coming to America, he came over and he said, look, he said, I'll talk to anybody who's willing to grow this. I'll tell them everything I know. All I want in return is a kilo of penicillin so I can do clinical trials. That's all I want. You guys can do anything else you want. Just give me a nice big vial, a nice big jar of penicillin, and we'll go on from there. And all through the war, he kept awaiting the shipment to come from America, which, in fact, never came, in part because after Heatley decided to stay on the war, America entered the war, and the Americans needed everything they had for here. And so no kilo ever showed up in England. But the hope was that by having Heatley on the spot, that his kilo would get there faster. Heatley was working at Merck, and a remarkable guy named John Fulton, who was a professor at Yale and who had been a Fulbright student, I'm sorry, a Rhodes Scholar with Florey in the early 1920s at Oxford, and was really his one, I think, close friend in the world. Florey famously only called people by their last name, no matter how long he had known them. But Fulton was the one person whom he called John, and John was wonderfully connected to really everybody in science in America and really largely throughout the world. And when Florey came to America, it was Fulton who took him under his wing, who had a party for him at his home in near Yale, where he was able to, over a 4th of July weekend, where on short notice he was able to round up almost everybody of note. And it was his putting his own credibility on the line for his friend, I think, that really helped Florey and Heatley enormously.
You
caught up in your own story. Where you're trying to go. The result of that is John Fulton is lying in a hospital bed at Yale University Hospital from a viral infection he's picked up doing some war studies. And down the hall, treated by his own physician, is Ann Miller, the wife of the athletic department director. She's 33 years old. She's had a miscarriage, and as often was the case then, a terrible infection had set in. And for a month, she had a temperature of 105, 106 degrees. She couldn't eat. She was losing weight. She was wasting away and was really on nothing worked, and she was really on the verge of death. When the mutual doctor of Fulton and Mrs. Miller recalled something that Fulton said about his friend Howard Florey and penicillin and said, I'm going to lose this patient. Can you prevail on Merck to get some penicillin for us just to try it? And Fulton starts calling around and takes several calls, and everything is protected by the government at that point. But enough is released. About half of the amount in the United States is released to come down to Yale, about a teaspoon, 5.5 grams. Nobody knows exactly how much to give Mrs. Miller. But they give a small injection, and they check it, and nothing. She has no bad reaction, so they give her a little bit more, and then they start doing it every 4 hours. And there's this wonder. There's this. Within 24 hours, she has no fever. She's eating again, and over the next 30 days, enough is manufactured to send her home. She really is the first person to be pulled successfully from the grave. She went home in 1942. I became interested in this story by reading her obituary in the New York Times in 1999. Mm-hmm. I read obituaries because it's a great way to say goodbye to somebody you like, and a final chance to meet somebody, if only at the last moment, if you'd missed them before. And it was two columns and a picture. I said, gee, two columns and a picture. Who is this person? It's Ann Miller, not the dancer. And I read through the whole thing, and it talks about Fleming in 1928, and it talks about the penicillin and all. And it says only that it was developed by a group at Oxford. And I said, but it doesn't say who this group at Oxford is. Well, I'm thinking, gee, this is 1942, that's 1928. Suddenly there's this other group. Why did it take so long? Why are there other people? And then I started looking into it, and here we are today.
Mm. Well, our guest in this part of Focus is Eric Lax, and he has authored this book, which we're talking about, The Mold in Dr. Florey's Coat, The Story of the Penicillin Miracle, and it's published by Henry Holt. It's out now in the bookstores if you want to read it. And questions, welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, this gets us to the central question here, and that is, how is it that when people think about it, whatever they know about penicillin, they know Fleming, but they don't know these other names. In I think that this was in 1942 in Britain, the popular press there started writing a lot about penicillin and saying this is a miracle drug and it's fabulous and we really ought to go into large-scale production. So there started to be a lot of attention generated. And I guess here, again, the question is, well, why is it that immediately everybody goes to Fleming? He gets all this attention. He gets all this credit, whereas he, in fact, deserved to have credit for the discovery. But it was these other scientists who actually developed it into a product, into a usable drug that could be a usable medicine that could be given to people.
Right. That of course was one of the great interests for me. I think there are a couple of points to explain it. One is that often the first way a story is told, if it's told artfully enough, is the one that people remember. The second one is that there's no there's nothing better for credit than great public relations. And in both instances, Fleming benefited from the way the story was told in the beginning, and he had far and away the better public relations team for two reasons. Not that he sought it out. He worked for his entire career from about 1906 until he died in 1955, at St. Mary's Hospital in London, a private hospital that relied on the goodwill of its patrons to survive. The head of the what was called the inoculation department where he worked was this wonderful, larger-than-life character named Almroth Wright, who was really the subject for George Bernard Shaw really used him for the character of Colenso Ridgeon in The Doctor's Dilemma. It was when in 1942, a friend of Fleming's was at death's door from what turned out to be meningitis. And Fleming wrote to Florey at Oxford saying, do you have any penicillin you can spare for this man? And Florey wrote back and said, yes, I'll be happy to give you some that I have if you'll count the case in our clinical trials. We have so little, we want every case to be documented. They said, fine, they do that. Well, it had its same remarkable turnaround that we've seen in both Alexander and Mrs. Miller, to the point that within a couple of weeks, the man was perfectly well, and a month he was home. A story appeared in the Times of London at the end of August in 1942, and it was talking about penicillin. It was doing two things. One was that there had been, Florey had quite famously, and perhaps to his eternal loss, done everything he could not to publicize what was going on. He didn't want people asking for a drug that he knew that nobody was not going to be available on any scale at all for years, or what appeared to be years. And so he kept it very quiet, and published only just a couple of pieces in The Lancet, which only scientists read. But the Times of London said, well, you know, The Lancet had just come out and said, we need to do more on penicillin, and the Times picked up that story. And Almuthwright wrote a letter to the Times saying, yes, it's important to do this, and word had come out that this man, Harry Lambert, had been cured. And it was Wright who said, you know, this was developed right here at State Hospital, and we should be giving out the laurel wreath of credit to Alexander Fleming, in whose lab this wonderful drug was first discovered. Well, you know, this is pretty dramatic stuff. So the press runs over to the hospital, and there's Fleming, who's this very laconic Scotsman. He's about 5'5". He looks perfect for the part. And, you know, he talks to them, and they take pictures, and he goes off. And, well, a scientist at Oxford, a man named Robert Robinson, who would win the Nobel Prize for Chemistry a few years later, writes a letter and says, well, as long as we're giving out laurel wreaths, how about a nice bouquet anyway for Florey and his comrades here at the Dunn School, who turned this into a practical proposition. So all the press gets on the train. They go to London. They go to Oxford. They show up at the lab. Florey, who hated publicity and did not want to spread the hope that this could be anything useful anytime soon, sent out his secretary and said, he won't meet with you today. If you come back next week, or next Tuesday, he may give you 10 minutes. Now, by every standard of medicine at the time, when self-promotion could get you thrown out of the medical profession, and you didn't advertise, he did the right thing. By his own standards, he did the right thing. But it's by the standards of Fleet Street, it's hard to imagine a worse decision than the one he made that day. Because if you're a newspaper man and you're going to write about penicillin, and you've got one place where people will talk to you, and you've got another place where you've got this ill-tempered Australian who sends out a secretary, you say, well, gosh, let's write the story the other way. The other two things that really helped for Fleming is that he had very powerful backers in Lord Beaverbrook, the press magnate, who was very, very friendly with Lord Moran, who was Winston Churchill's private physician. Moran and Fleming had gone to medical school together at St. Mary's, as a matter of fact. And there was, at a dark time, at a time for England, there was a sense of wanting to, I think, cast an English hero. And I think that Moran and Beaverbrook felt that if they could put the focus onto Fleming, it would be sort of a bright spot for the English people. It would also do a tremendous amount for the hospital, to which they were both attached. And in fact, it did bring in a considerable amount of money for St. Mary's, which probably would have folded, I think, without all this. So that is, it was catch up for the Oxford team from then on. They were never, even when the Nobel Prizes were awarded, the New York Times, in reporting it, did it in such a way that it appeared that Florey and Cheyne were sort of junior colleagues of Fleming, although they had never worked together, and it was in fact they who had turned it into a drug. And there was, in fact, a retraction the next day, or a clarification the next day, saying, wait a minute, we didn't quite get this headline right. So even when they got the prize, they still didn't quite get the credit. And as for Heatley, you know, he had no credit at all.
Yeah, because the prize went to Fleming, Florey, and Cheyne, and I guess there was some rule that says you can't give it to more than three people. So Heatley, who was so important in developing the techniques for producing it, he was left out.
Right, and part of it too is that, you know, if there's the curious way in which the Nobels work too, is that he was very much seen, even though he had a PhD, he was very much seen as Florey's hands, the man who really sort of carried out the work, and not seen so much for the ingenuity that he brought to it. Part of this was his own extraordinarily shy and reticent personality. He would never do anything to push himself forward in any way. And also, I think that some of the Nobel Prizes that are given now, this kind of achievement of like Heatley's is recognized. But at the time, it really wasn't. It was the it was the great doctors who were given it, not the associates. I'll say, well, no matter how great their contribution.
We have about 7-8 minutes left. We have a couple of callers. Let's see if we can get them in Champaign, line one. Hello.
I was wondering if your guest had any opinions on the use of antibiotics today, and whether they might be losing their effectiveness due to overuse. For example, I understand that they are used with farm animals as a prophylactic to stop diseases before they occur or in bad living conditions. And I know, well, it seems anyway, there was 100 people who died in a hospital in Canada recently over the last 18 months because of an illness called called C. diff. And I know that my mother also had that, and they couldn't use Flagyl. They had to use vancomycin, which you can only use in the most extreme cases because they're trying to save it, for the worst-case scenario. So do you have any...
Yes.
Okay.
Oh, thank you. It's a very good question, the answer is that one of the great, I think that through some ignorance and misuse, we've really squandered one of the great scientific developments of history, is that very early on, I mean, in the 1940s when it was first put out, it was being prescribed for everything. There was penicillin lipstick. People were giving it for viruses against which it has no use whatsoever. Often doctors would do it without going through the whole course of treatment that was necessary. And the result of this was really that, resistance doesn't move backwards. So certain bacteria would pick up a little bit of a Darwinian advantage here. They would change just enough to be able to counteract penicillin because they had, like Nietzsche says, what doesn't kill me makes me stronger. And what's happened over generations or decades is that very thing, is that through misuse, through not giving it long enough, and that antibiotics have become ineffective in some cases. The case that you mentioned about in the hospital, there are we read about these terrible epidemics where in confined places with people with weakened conditions that these bacteria are very opportunistic. Although in people I was talking with in doing this book, that still for the general population in most cases, penicillin is still and subsequent antibiotics are still holding their own, but there are. It's a looming problem, and one that is scary in its consequences.
Mm. Let's see if we can get at least one more. We'll go to Champaign here, line two. Hello.
Oh, good morning.
Yes.
Interesting program. When I was a very young person, I read a book, a Russian book, and in it, a fellow was wounded. And they slapped a moldy piece of bread on his wound. And I was horrified. But in the story, he got well. Could that have been penicillin?
Well, there are instances through many hundreds of years of fungal folk medicines like that being used that actually had some effect. From Ukraine to Mexico, that in many cultures there would be either something made out of corn or made out of bread that would have a mold on it, that would seem to have some effect in some cases on this. So it's you can't imagine how impure this is as opposed to the normal penicillin, but it was in fact a useful folk remedy, and there are, as I say, hundreds of years of examples of it. So there's clearly something in there. What it is, of course, is something that's working at 0.1% of its effectiveness. What was interesting is those mice, when they did the first experiment in 1942, they thought that they had something really quite extraordinary here, and it was only later on that they realized there were so many impurities in there that it was really less than 1% penicillin, and the remaining 99% was extraneous stuff. So between May of 1940, when they did that, and 1942, when it was really a practical drug, they found a way to purify it much better.
Yeah. Well, I think we're at the point here where we're going to have to stop, and I'm sorry we have another caller that we're not going to be able to take, but I think there's plenty in the book. If people are interested in reading more on this story, they can look for the book that we've talked about, The Mold in Dr. Florey's Coat, The Story of the Penicillin Miracle. Eric Lax is the guest. Maybe just as one real quick last thought, I want to make sure we get in here that Florey and the men who worked with him did not get vastly wealthy from their work, as they might have.
Right. Not at all. I mean, it's just a small amount. The Nobel Prize was a very small amount at that time. And it was really a man named Edward Abraham who was very, very helpful in leading the way toward getting the chemical composition of penicillin, who understood the difference in patenting it. In the 1950s, developed cephalosporin. He patented it, the whole ring around of this, and in fact, not only became wealthy himself, but made several trusts for Oxford that so far have paid in the vicinity of about £90 million.
Well, thanks, Eric, very much for giving us some of your time today. We certainly appreciate
it. Pleasure.
Again, the book is The Mold in Dr. Florey's Coat, published by Henry Holt, by our guest, Eric Lax. The broadcast today made possible with support from Lincoln Square Mall in Urbana, with more than a dozen shops, businesses, and restaurants, including Pretty Nails, Milo's Restaurant, and McCandless Photography, located on the lower level, still using a traditional film process to create contemporary portraits. The programming is also made possible by grants from 10,000 Villages in downtown Champaign and Crossroads Global Handcrafts, 428 North Main in Bloomington, providing income to third world artisans by marketing their handicrafts and telling their stories in North America. Again, a reminder that tomorrow morning on the program, in the first part of the program, we'll be talking with Omer Bartoff. He's professor of history at Brown University, and we'll be here on the campus to give a talk in the MillerCom series. We've had a lot of these people on our show over the years. This is the first one this fall. He'll be talking about images of Jews in 20th century cinema, something that he's written a book on. That'll be in hour one. Then in the second part of the program, we'll be talking with Tim Junkin. He's both a lawyer and a novelist, and he's author of a new nonfiction book that's about the first death row inmate who was exonerated by DNA. His name was Kirk Bloodsworth, and this happened in 1992, and he has written a book that tells that story. So you can hear it tomorrow in the second part of Focus 580, the second hour. We are here weekday mornings from 10 until noon. We have 10 different topics for you every week, and we always welcome your questions and comments. And we hope that you will stay tuned, because coming up next, there's news and sports and weather and lots of things coming up as part of the Afternoon Magazine. The host, Celeste Quinn.
Thank you, David. Coming up today in the 1 o'clock hour of the Afternoon Magazine, an archive interview with journalist Evan Wright, author of Generation Kill, Devil Dogs, Iceman, Captain America, and the New Face of American War. The book is about a unit of Marines given the assignment to race ahead of American battle forces in Iraq. That interview follows the 1 o'clock news this afternoon. Prices are higher on the Chicago Board of Trade and Mercantile Exchange. Let's take a look at the specifics. September wheat, 303, up 1.5. December, 315.75, up 1.5. September corn, 223.5, up 3.25. December, 233.5, up 4.5. March, 241.75, up 4.25. December, 259, up 3.5. September bean, 622, up 21.5. No.